Morning. I thought it would be maybe a good idea after the first talk for this morning to add another word to the title of my talk. So I'm going to talk about non-optimal characterization of quantum states and gates and trapped ions. And now you might wonder, why should one use to want non-optimal methods? And of course, this is because we have some constraints in the experiments. And so I guess the purpose of this talk is also to give you an introduction about how we do state measurements in general in trapped ion experiments, and what prevents us from using maybe optimal techniques. And so I will give you an outline of the experiments that we perform, and then talk a bit about tomography of entangled states and of quantum gate operations that we have performed in the last couple of years. So just to start with, I want to also give you an overview of the experiments that we do in Innsbruck with trapped ions. And there are several areas. So we have interest in precision spectroscopy, and particular ions are good as optical frequency standards. So this goes in the direction of what Robin started with in the morning, that you can perform precision measurements using using trapped ions. Then the main field of research we're doing with trapped ions is in quantum information processing. And here, for example, we have done measurements where we entangled a number of ions and analyzed these states, and also recently performed high fidelity quantum gate operations. And then there's also a field where the two come together in quantum metrology. And again, here we have also done experiments where we used explicitly entangled states for precision measurements of atomic quantities. And in all these areas, quantum measurements are important. So for example, in quantum metrology, many problems can be formulated as phase estimation, where you have, where you infer the relevant information by determining the phase of a superposition state. And in my talk, I want to focus on this quantum information aspect, where we analyze, for example, quantum gate operations by looking at the states that we produce using these operations, using tomography. And in quantum information processing, we're following this the standard quantum circuit scheme, where we initialize our ion qubits, where we then perform a number of single qubit and entangling gate operations. And in the end, we have a readout of our system. And just to show you where we are at the moment, we can initialize our qubits with a fairly high fidelity. We have single qubit gate operations that work with a fidelity of better than 99%. With entangling gates, the fidelity is not quite as good, and ranges probably between 90 and 99%, whereas at this high end, there has so far not been any rigorous characterization of the gate. So I'll talk about that in a moment. And also the detection process, that's one of the big advantages of ions, is able to detect the quantum state with a fairly high fidelity. And in all these steps, to infer these numbers, we need quantum measurements. So when we initialize our state, then we can talk about a success probability of the initialization only after having performed measurements. The same, of course, is true for the evaluation of the single and qubit gates and entangling gates. Currently, we do experiments which are rather modest in terms of the number of ions that we can use, and also in the number of gate operations that we apply. And so the challenges in these experiments consist in increasing the number of ions in the experiments, and also in reducing the error rates in the quantum gates in order to be able to concatenate a bigger number of these gate operations. Now, also, I added another slide just after the break, because I thought I should also present another photo of what a quantum computer might look like in the experiments. And so what you can see here is an optical table with plenty of equipment that is used in feedback loops, and also in sending laser beams to the trap, which you can see here in the vacuum vessel. So in the center of this vacuum vessel, we have our ion trap. And in between this electrode configuration, we can then trap strings of ions. But I want to go back to a simple description. And so this is a schematic overview of our setup. We have a linear ion trap that enables us to confine strings of ions in the center of this arrangement. because of the Coulomb repulsion, the distance between the ions is on the order of maybe 5 micrometers. And that is important because it makes it possible to focus a laser beam down that we can manipulate an individual ion with this beam. And also, we can detect the fluorescence of the ions using a CCD camera or a photomultiplier. And this can be done in a way that we resolve the positions of the individual ions. And that makes it possible to do measurements on individual of these quantum systems. The quantum bit we are interested in is encoded in 2 energy levels of calcium plus ions, either of calcium 40 or calcium 43. And typically, in most experiments, we use the S1/2 ground state of the atom and then use a metastable state, which has a lifetime of about 1 second. And we can encode information in these 2 energy levels and manipulate our quantum bit using coherent laser radiation. Sure. No. We cannot. We resolve the fluorescence optically, so we cannot resolve features smaller than the wavelength of the light that is used for detecting the ion. And in this case, the resolution is not even on the wavelength scale. It's rather set by the quality of the lens that is used for imaging the fluorescence of the ions to the camera. Yeah. The position of the ions is we can localize an ion to a position on the order of 10 nanometers. That is the quantum limit set by the confining force in the ion trap. But this is not something which can be seen by taking these pictures. And so in my talk, I will just focus on this 3-level structure. So we have 2 energy levels that we use for encoding our quantum information. And then there's a 3rd one that will be used for reading out the quantum information from the quantum bit. And just to come back to that question, the ions are separated by a distance of about 5 micrometers. And this is a huge distance on an atomic scale, because you have to compare this to the Bohr radius of an atom. So the atoms are really extremely far apart, not in the way as it might look on this picture from a naive point of view. And this means that, first of all, there's no direct interaction between the atoms. This is hard. I mean, this is in NMR experiments, it's perfect because you have nice spin-spin interactions because the ions, the spins are so close together on the molecule. This is not the case in the trapped ion experiments. It has, on the other hand, an advantage because you don't need to be afraid of interactions between the particles because they are so far apart. And this means that each ion constitutes a good realization of a qubit because it's well separated from everything else in the rest of the world. And so we encode each qubit in an individual ion, and in this way we can encode simple superposition states of a qubit. And the big problem in ion trap experiments is how to make the ions interact. How can we induce an entangling interaction? And this cannot be done by a direct coupling between the internal degrees of freedom of these ions, but there is a 2nd degree of freedom, and that is the movement of the ions in the trap. We have the Coulomb repulsion that acts between the ions, and because of this Coulomb repulsion, we get ion crystals. And when we excite these ions in their different motional modes that we can excite, and here you can see movies that we took, where we excite either the center of mass mode of motion of the ion string or the next motional mode, which occurs at a higher frequency, which is a stretch mode. And then there are more complex modes of motion that can also be excited. And yes, the laser waste
ion.
So so we can focus the laser down maybe to a distance of 2 micrometers.
Okay.
Sorry, a follow-up question on that. So how many ions you can, is that possible to selectively choose 2 of them?
Yes, that is possible.
They have to come close to each other, though, because...
Yes, so let's say, just keep in mind that ions in our experiment never come closer to each other than 5 micrometers.
Okay.
And that is big enough so that we can send a laser beam and manipulate a single ion without affecting the neighboring ions.
With so some tricks? I mean, if you said 2 micron waste?
Yes. No. Yeah, it's roughly the waste, yeah.
But this is not possible in a linear array of ions.
Why not?
Because for, like, you know, far distance ions, you know, how do you interact?
Yeah, I'll tell you in a moment. So we need a way to make these two interact. And there's one joint degree of freedom, and that is the motion of the ions in the pair. So what we can do is we can, in this case, it's done just by supplying an additional electric voltage to one of the trap electrodes, which pushes the ion in one direction. And when we do it resonantly, we can excite one of these motional modes. But this can be also done in a somewhat refined way, and that is by using laser radiation, which excites an atom from the ground state to the excited state. At the same time, it transfers momentum to the ion spin. And in that way, we can entangle the internal state of the ion with the vibrational state of the ion spin. And so let's go back one step. So we have these motional modes, which can be approximated by harmonic oscillators. So we have the situation is the following. We have now our internal states of the ions, and we have a collection of harmonic oscillators. And the general strategy in ion trap experiments is to use lasers which couple the ion qubit to the harmonic oscillator, which is a joint property of the qubits. And in this way, we entangle the internal state of the ions with the vibrational state that we have here in a transient way. And we need to devise the sequence of laser pulses, which in the end disentangles the qubits from these external degrees of freedom so that we are just left with an effective interaction which might look like a spin-spin interaction.
Why can't you avoid this by making your laser beam a little broader and shining a beam on two ions at once and doing an adjacent two-qubit gate that way?
This is something we actually do. So there are two strategies for making progress. And I'll come to that in a moment.
Okay.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Can I ask a probably stupid question? I mean, is that sometimes related to the Zerenz and Wollmann scheme, which I proposed around 99? I mean, they also have that where they couple their qubits to the vibrational mode and use the vibrational mode as a transfer qubit in their bus qubit.
It is related, but all ion trap experiments that have shown entanglement between ions, mm-hmm. in deterministic entanglement between ions, have used this kind of coupling. It's a general coupling. So you always need to couple to the vibrational, then you need to couple the vibrational degree of freedom in a way that depends on the internal state of the qubits. Mm-hmm. And then there are different schemes. You can either have a laser which interacts with a single ion at a time, mm-hmm. or you can use laser interaction which interacts with all of the qubits at the same time. And as that's one of the problems of Möllmann and Sørensen, and which in the end disentangles the vibrational degree of freedom and gives rise to an effective.
Sort of the whole idea originally was suggested by Serac and Zoller before Möllmann and Sørensen came up with their very clever generalization of that.
And so let's just go back to a single ion for a moment. If we have a single ion, then we have our qubit, which has two levels. These are the internal states of our ion. Then we have the vibrational state of the ion that moves, for example, along a certain direction in the trap. And we can represent these two quantum systems by using the joint energy level diagram. So we have the qubit state, which I will call in my talk S and D, which are the atomic states. And then we have the vibrational states of the harmonic oscillator 0, 1, 2, and so on. And using laser light, we can now either decide to resonantly couple the qubit on this transition, and this is what is called the carrier excitation. In that case, we couple only the internal state of the qubit without affecting the vibrational states. and by choosing a suitable duration of this laser pulse, we can now perform, for example, a pi over 2, pi over 2 pulse or a pi pulse. This is what you can see here. Here we vary the duration of the laser excitation. We start with both with the ion in the S state, so it's the D state population that is measured. And for example, if we stop here at this point, then we have transformed the S state into a position of S plus D. If we go on, then we do a spin flip and transfer S to D and D to S and so on. Now, this is what is used for performing single qubit operations. In order to achieve this entanglement I talked about, we can now tune the laser to make it resonant with the transition where upon excitation to the D state, we also increase the vibrational quantum number by 1. And the coupling that we have here depends on the vibrational quantum number. And you can see here that if the ion is in the S state, then this pulse is able to change the vibrational quantum number. However, if it's in the D state, there is no level, the D level can put couple to, then the vibrational state is not altered at all. And this is exactly the conditional dynamics we're looking for. Because it means that when you perform the same experiment that I have shown you before, where you see these Ravi oscillations on the transition on this upper side band, then it means we have a coupling between the Sn state and the Dn plus 1 state. So starting in a superposition of S plus D, where N, for example, is a vibrational ground state, and applying this pulse for a certain time, we're able to entangle the qubit state with the vibrational state of the ion. And then the question is, what do we need to do to transfer this entanglement from the vibrational state to a second ion using further laser pulses? And so since the focus here is not so much on entangling interactions, but rather on measurements, I decided that I maybe should not give you an introduction how we actually entangle ions in detail. There are different techniques, and one of them that we have used for a couple of years relies on these strongly focused laser beams, which entangle a single ion with a vibrational degree of freedom, and then entangle. Then we switch the laser to a different ion and perform another operation which couples the other qubit to the vibrational degree of freedom. And in this way, by using a number of pulses, for example, you can map the qubit number 1 to the vibrational state. Then you can perform a C-NOT gate operation between two levels of this vibrational state, which controls the second qubit. And then you can map it back again, information to the qubit. And in this way, you can perform a C-NOT gate operation. But there are also other techniques of having entangled interactions. These are the Milner-Jørgensen gate operations. And that is something that we realized this year, and which turned out to be extremely successful. And here you have a collective laser beam which interacts with all qubits in the same way and entangles the qubit states with the vibrational degree of freedom transiently. And at the end of the gate operation, the entanglement, there's only entanglement between the qubits, but no entanglement with the vibrational state. And so we can use this laser interaction to realize a pulse which corresponds to a pulse generated by an effective Hamiltonian, which describes correlated spin flips between the ions. And with this technique, we have been able to entangle two qubits with fidelity of 99.3%. And so this is extremely promising for us because it shows that we have now a major improvement in the fidelity of the states that we can produce. And therefore, we are optimistic that we can, in the future, perform more complex gate operations than we have demonstrated so far. But of course, the question is, how do we prove that we have Bell states of this fidelity? And more in general, can we characterize this gate operation completely by using quantum process tomography? That's something which we have not done so far. So the topic is to characterize quantum gates by performing tomography on the states that we produce using these gates. So the general outline of our experiment is that we first have to, we have to initialize our system with a high fidelity to a well-defined quantum state. This is done by laser cooling techniques and optical pumping. Then in the second step, we perform our coherent operation on the qubits, which consists in an excitation of this metas, this forbidden transition between the qubit states using laser light. And in the end, we have to read out the result of these coherent manipulations by a fluorescence measurement. And this is done in the following way. So we have, for a single ion, the scheme is sketched here, we have two energy levels that we need to distinguish. And we can do this by coupling one of these levels to a third level, which can only decay back by spontaneous emission to the same state. And that makes it possible to scatter many, many photons within a short detection time. And in this way, when we switch on this laser, which couples the S state to the P state, then two things can happen. Either the superposition state between S and D is projected onto the S state, and in that case, we will scatter many photons in this transition and observe the ion as a bright object. But it can also happen that the superposition is projected onto the D state. In that case, the atom does not couple to the laser field that it tries to excite. And so no photons will be scattered, and we won't see that an ion is there.
Or is it a demolition measurement?
It is, well.
Can you keep using the ion after you project?
We can keep using it afterwards, yes. I mean, of course, for a short time, we leave our qubit subspace because the ion is excited to the P state. But at the end of the measurement, it is a non-demolition measurement. That's fine. Let's say if the ions are Doppler cooled, if they're not in the ground state, then we are still in the same vibrational state. From that point of view, I think it can be interpreted as a non-demolition measurement. And so when we detect the fluorescence with a photomultiplier and do this, so we repeat the initial sequence 100,000 times, then we can record the number of photons that we detect within our detection window, which is shown here, and then make a histogram. And you can see here this is a log scale that we have a bimodal distribution. So either we observe that the ion scatters many, many photons, this is this block here, or it scatters hardly any photons at all. And these can be attributed now to the ion being in the S state or in the D state. So after what I said, in principle, if the ion is in the D state, the ion does not scatter light at all. But of course, in the experiment, we still see a little bit of light because laser light is reflected by trapped electrodes. And in this way, still detected. So we have a little bit of stray light, which is responsible for this part here. And what you can also see is that the separation is not perfect. And this is due to the fact that the state here is metastable, so it has a lifetime of about 1 second. And the detection time is, in this case, 3 milliseconds. So we have a chance on the order of 0.2% that the D state decays to the S state during the measurement. And there are techniques to improve this discrimination between the D and the S state, work by the Oxford group of Andrew Steen. And that makes it possible to make the separation here even better. Now, in many cases, when we want to repeat an experiment over and over again, and then we have we want to calculate expectation values. And in that case, it does not matter if we wrongly attribute maybe a D state to the S state, if the probability is the same for wrongly attributing an S state to the D state. And so we can fit here these Poissonian distributions to the states and then estimate the state with high fidelity. If we have more than two ions, we can do the same with the camera. And you can see here for two ions, we can discriminate between four different quantum states. Now, when you have a Bell state, then this camera detection is already helpful in determining which state we might have produced in the experiment, because when we do this fluorescence detection, then out of the four possibilities that you have here, we should only observe the two the SD and the DS state if we have here a belt state like SD plus DS. But it does not answer the question whether we have a superposition state. If we have a superposition state, what is the phase, or is it a mixed state? And for this reason, we need to do more measurements. That is, we want to measure the density matrix to show that this is indeed the state that we think we have produced in the experiment. Now, how do we do these measurements? In a single qubit, we can represent the density matrix by the Bloch vector and need to measure the components of the Bloch vector. And for example, to measure the spin projection onto the z-axis, where we associate the S state and the D state with the eigenvalues of the sigma z operator. We have our natural measurement basis. So here we have a direct one-to-one match between a projection onto the plus one eigenvalue of the sigma z operator and the detection or maybe the absence of fluorescence. When we measure onto a different basis, then we need to combine our fluorescence measurement with a coherent operation before we do the measurement. So what we do to project onto the sigma onto the eigensets of sigma x and sigma y is to form a pi over two pulse which rotates our Bloch vector and then do a measurement in the sigma z basis. And this also shows you an important point in, I guess, all experimental realizations of quantum information processing. There is normally one good measurement basis. And if you want to do other measurements, you need to do coherent operations which are more or less the same that you also apply when you produce a state. So if we want to analyze a single qubit gate, then we need, in principle, also single qubit gates for transforming the state for the measurements. And when we have n qubits, well, then we can do the same, perform the same strategy. We can represent our density matrix by a sum of orthogonal and suitably normalized variables, and then measure the expectation values of these observables, which in our case are always products of spin projections. And this is exactly because we do not want to perform an entangling gate operation for doing a measurement, because we know that the fidelity of this entangling gate operation is not as good as the fidelity of single qubit rotations. Now, this direct reconstruction technique will not work in our experiment because we can only do the experiment a finite number of times. So for a single qubit, for example, when we have a pure state, then it is highly likely that because we have some measurement uncertainty in these variables that we might end up in a state which is outside the state space of the good density matrices. And so our directly reconstructed matrix might have negative eigenvalues. And then the theorists among you will not be happy when we present you a density matrix with these properties. And so for that reason, we do a maximum likelihood estimation. And so we try to look for the density matrix which is most likely to reproduce the results that we observe in the experiment. So we do, in principle, the same measurements that we would need for a direct realization. So we project onto a set of quantum states, and we count how often we observe the projection onto these states. And then we try to maximize the log likelihood function in the experiment. And for a two-qubit state, for example, this means that we prepare a Bell state. We do a measurement in the sigma z basis, do this experiment 200 times, then go to a different measurement basis, do again to measure these expectation values. The two qubits means we have 9 different settings because for each qubit we want to do measurements on sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z, and then want to have the products of all of these operators. And in that way, we arrive at a density matrix like this one here. And it's interesting to see that we have 9 different settings, and the time in the experiment takes about 40 seconds for this reconstruction. Then we can go on and study multiparticle entangled states of 3 ions. This is, for example, an example of the W state that we produced. And then can try to see how far we can go with this procedure. So this is, again, a W state. Here I just show you the absolute value of the density matrix elements. And then we can do it with 4 ions, with 5 ions, with 6 ions, with 7 ions and maybe should have run a bit slower. But you can see here with 6 ions, it already takes 3 to the 6th measurement settings, and this means that the measurement time goes up. So here we are 40 minutes of reconstruction time. When we go to 7, then we have 2 hours because we need more than 2,000 measurements, and with 8 ions in the end, we have 6,000 measurements, and it takes about 10 hours because we, in the measurement process, we created the same state about 600,000 times. And then afterwards, we are left with about 1.5 million different expectation values that we have. And the question is, how do we combine all the data sets to reconstruct the density matrix, which is indeed positive? Yes, exactly. And we use, in these experiments, we use the density matrix that we reconstructed to prove that the state is indeed a particle entangled.
And how it decays with the number of qubits?
You can see here. It gets worse with the time, but not too much. We stopped here because we didn't want to measure for 3 days in a row. And so then you can extend this scheme. You can go to quantum process tomography and try to reconstruct the try to reconstruct the map that you have here, because we have now decoherence going on. And we have done this for the controlled NOT gate operation and also for quantum teleportation. Since I think my time is running up, I maybe should stress one point. So this is a first tomography of the CNOT gate operation, where you can now try to measure how good is the process fidelity or how good is the mean fidelity. And then the question is, do we know everything after having done this process fidelity measurement for the CNOT gate operation? Can, for example, when we concatenate now our two gate operations, can we then predict the outcome of the result? I think that's something which is important from an experimental point of view, because you think you have a good measurement strategy for characterizing a gate operation. And what you see here is that when you do two gate operations, it should be the identity. So we have just more or less one element which is important. And when we compare the prediction of the single gate operation, then we predict that the for example, the mean fidelity should be on the order of 86%, and we find that it's a bit lower, and it seems to be outside the error bar. So this means that even if you're able to characterize a single qubit gate operation, it's not necessarily clear in the experiment whether you can predict afterwards what the outcome will be when you combine it in a bigger.
It's fair to say that this yellow, what you measure for operation, is like this Yamakovsky choice state corresponding to the operation. Is it similar?
I think so.
This, what you measure for a given operation, is as if you measure the state corresponding to the operation you study with respect to this Yamakovsky isomorphism, as Mauro mentioned before. I think so.
People are.
Yes, I think so. if you'd really done correct process tomography, then this would work, right? So
no, necessarily, because we assume that we have decoherence going on, and this is and we have a Markovian environment.
But so the problem is just that if you have the same math for the first operation and the second.
Yes.
And you've been pretending that they decoupled.
I mean, what we see in the current is that this assumption that we have a bath which has a short memory time is not necessarily a good one, because to put it in simpler terms, we know that we have fluctuating experimental parameters, and these tend to fluctuate slowly. And this means that when we perform one gate operation, then it is likely that a parameter will have the same deviation from its mean value as in the second operation. And that complicates the issue of characterizing.
Christian, we're basically in the question session now, so if you have any concluding remarks, you may want to get them in now before all the questions start.
Yeah, that's fine.
Because we do
that's
need okay. to stop
yeah.
at 12 sharp.
Yeah, that's fine. Right. So I just go to my last slide. So I skip the quantum teleportation. results. So what I hope to learn by attending this workshop is this is the first topic that I just mentioned. Are there good strategies? Because usually we are interested in the behavior of a gate operation in a large group. Are there good ways of characterizing entangling gate operations that maybe do not use process tomography? Are there other schemes? For examples for Nani Nil, who proposed to do some random operations that in the end characterize maybe the gate in a more practical setting. Is that maybe a better way? What shall we do when we have slowly fluctuating parameters and you do quantum state tomography? Then it would be nice for us to see, are there reliable algorithms that are sufficiently fast also for reconstructing a quantum state? And what shall we do, for example, when our qubit state space is smaller than the state space of the atom? Because I always talked about two levels, but in reality, our S1/2 ground state is composed of two states. The metastable state is composed of six states. We have in calcium 43. We have in total 64 states, and we identify two states for our qubit. And of course, there's always leakage. So these are practical issues that also need to be answered here. Thank you.
So there's 5 minutes remaining.